Mr. George Bell, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Bell?
11th of April, 1921.
And where?
I was born in number 14 Lumley Terrace at Great Lumley.
And could you tell us a little bit about your family background, you know?
Yes. I was one of three children. I was the youngest of three children. And my eldest brother became a clergyman. He finished up with an honorary canon down at Hagel. And my sister was an unqualified dispenser, right? And I was when I left school at 14.
Hang on, you're running ahead. And what sort of circumstances did you live in?
Oh, I see. A colliery house. Very poor in those days. We were quite poor in those days, as all miners were in those days. And my brother wanted to go to university, and he couldn't get a grant from the government or anything like that. And he applied for the grant to the miners' union, and they said if they would go to be a mining engineer, they would give him a grant, but not a clergyman. You know, such was the tenor of things in those days. And my brother and sister both went to grammar school, and I didn't. I failed the grammar school.
Well, tell me about your education then, from when you started.
And I went to the council school in Lumley. And I was there when the school opened, the school, Lumley Cochranleigh School, opened in 1931. I was there as a pupil then. And I sang at that ceremony. I remember that quite well, with old Mrs. Jones on the piano. I remember that. I was in the church choir at that time.
And what subjects did you concentrate on or enjoy?
Well, in a council school, you didn't get much choice. You had to concentrate on arithmetic and English in the mornings, you know, and anything else in the afternoon, you know, anything else that was going. And it was quite an ordinary council school, you know. I didn't have much education, but I always liked history. I was fanatic on history. Always did. And I used to be very envious of my brother and sister coming in and telling them I've done biology and all that sort of thing, which I hadn't done, you see. But I got the thirst for knowledge, and when I left school at 14...
So that'd be about 1935.
That's exactly right, 1935. When I left school, there was a tremendous depression in this area. And of course, all the lads were going off to the mines. And my father had said to me, "No, George, you're not going to the mines until they get windows in." Of course, that. Don't get the mines until they get windows in, that's it. And I avoided the mines. I was claustrophobic, you know. I didn't like the idea of being shut in like that. And I was very, hesitant about going to the mines. And I found a job. I was one of the few lads who found a job outside the mines. As an errand boy at Houghton East Spring.
A shop errand boy?
Yes, a shop errand boy. At Jones the chemist at Houghton East Spring. Yes, that's right. It's still there. And I stayed there for about a year.
Yeah.
And I found a job in Chester Street. Of course, I didn't have to travel. Because I travel on the bike, you see, every day from Lumley to Houghton East Spring. And therefore, I got a job in Chesterley Street.
What has there?
As a wireless and bicycle engine, you know. I was to repair bicycles and help with wireless, you know, as well. Well, wireless. The wireless in those days, you know, there were early wirelesses in those days. And that's what I did as a shop assistant there. And the man who owned it, called Wales, he closed his shops because he opened drift mines in Walbridge, just up the road here, Walbridge. And he took me with him. He took me with him as a clerk, as an apprentice clerk there. And I worked under the head clerk there called John Strong. And he used to amaze me because I thought he was wonderful. He would go behind figures like that, functions and things like that, and put the answer in three tech columns at once, you know, doing it like that. He was a great, great man. And
did you enjoy the work as an
apprentice? Yes, I did. I worked that because, we were poor. You had to live in those days. I think I mean, when I started Jones's, I got 6 shillings a week. 6 shillings for nothing, you know. And I got a big rise when I went to Wills at the bottom there, at the bottom of the street, Chester Street. I got a big rise. I was on 12 shillings a week, double, you know. So that was wonderful for me. And I enjoyed the work. One of the jobs I had was, you know, that they used to haul the clothes off the drift mine, you know, they used to haul the clothes with a ramp like that. And they used to have an old sauce bus, you know, which had the wheel removed and a cable drum on the back. And it used to pull the tubes up there, and I used to get out and drive that thing. With me willies on, I used to get out and drive that thing. When the wrapper went, I used to get out and drive that thing. I thought that was great fun. I'd never driven in my life, you see. I was only 16-year-old thereabouts then, and that was a great thrill for me. However,
how long did you stay there?
I stayed there till 1938. And I left because I went for a job in the Royal Ordnance Factory at Birtley. And there were 71 lads in for that job. I think I remember correctly, 71 lads in for that job. And we were interviewed all day by a man, called Mr. Len Happy, who was the interior master at that time, you know, the labour officer. And I didn't leave that place for me dinner even. I thought I'd want that job, you know. It was an apprentice bookkeeper, you know. And I was attending AIM classes for bookkeeping at that time, you see. And I wanted that job if I could get it. And I got it the last 7. And I thought, my goodness, that's wonderful, that, you know. Last 7. And when I went home, my brother said, "Oh, you have no chance, George." I said, "Why do I have no chance?" He said, "There were 6 grammar school people in Tullat," he said. "One was called Church and one was called Watson." I remember their names. And I said, "I have no chance for that job, have I not?" And he said, "Oh no, 6 grammar school people will beat you into a fit, you know." And I said, "That was the fit he had in me, you know." So I thought, I never forgot that. I thought, that's awful. But lo and behold, I got it. I got it because I'd gone in class for bookkeeping, and therefore they wanted bookkeepers, you see, and that was therefore my forte, and I got in.
And that was 1938?
That was January the 4th, 1938, I started, yes. Yes, I did. I started 1938, January the 4th. I remember that name at that time as well. The significant in your lifetime, you know.
And what was work like there at the Ordnance Factory?
Well, I worked in the factory itself. In the factory itself, where I didn't do anything, in the technical line at all. I was on the commercial line, you know. I worked with the rate fixer. The rate fixer in those days, he was called a rate fixer in those days. Now he's called a time motor filling man, isn't he? And that was my job. I used to help to time machines and write out the various work cards and that sort of thing. And I was engaged in that all the time I was there. But you know, during the war, of course, I'm going to hurt
you. Yeah. Just before we go into that, were you interested in sport? Did you have any major hobbies?
Yes, I was football.
Let's talk about that then.
And the tennis player. We met on tennis court, don't you know?
What sporting activities? Tell us a bit about your sport then.
Oh, I did well at football. In fact, I tried for Arsenal and everything else, and you know. I didn't succeed then, but they always said, "Go away, Jordan, grow up, you know, too small, get some more smoke in your shoes." that was what he said. The manager of Arsenal said that, George Ellison, he said, "Go away and get some more hot smoke in your shoes, and grow yourself a bit," because I was small then, you know.
Who did you play for locally?
I played in the right wing. I played for Lambton down the road, and I played for Warwick. I never played for Lumley. I would put me on to a football town and used to say, "Come play for us, no, I play against you." And indeed, I always played against them. And I played quite a lot of local football here.
Just amateur then, but not...
Just amateur, so yes, amateur. Nothing professional at all, you know. But I did, during the war, get a chance to play for Morton as a guest, you know. That sort of thing.
Well, we'll come on to that. Yes, now, what about, you mentioned tennis. Was that your summer game?
Yes, tennis. We played tennis. We played Chester courts here, tennis, you know, yes. There were no courts in London, of course, except the private courts. The doctors had a private court. A doctor had a private court in here. But we weren't allowed anywhere near that, you see. We were just mining people's community, you see, and we were very poor. And actually, my brother and sister had a struggle, you know, after grammar school exams, you know, after passing them. When they wanted to get back in the industry, they had a Tom, of course, that was, had to study hard being in university, but my sister never went, you know.
Now, what about, did you see the outbreak of war coming? Did you follow what was going on in Germany?
Yes, well, I should go back a bit here. In my family history, is a major event. My father was killed in the mine in 1940. August 1940, my father was hurt in the mine and he died 3 days later. His headstone still at Lumley. Jackie Bell died of his injuries, you know. And he was what they call a chock drawer. That means a man that lets the roof down when they finish and puts it up before the start, you know. And dangerous job, and of course a stone fell upon a stone, you know, trapped him. And he was killed. He was actually injured, and then he died 3 days later, which was tragic for the family, you know. And the others were left to bring favours. I was 19 then. My brother was left to bring the favours up on very little money, you know. So we were poor. We had a poor back then.
Now, before that, though, with the outbreak of war, had you seen that coming at all?
Well...
Were you interested in foreign affairs or politics or anything?
Yes, I was interested in politics, yes. Oh, yes, we could see that coming. We followed... I was always keen on the Navy, you know. And we followed all the things that happened, you know. The British were great with a naval power, you know. And we were great at that. And I used to follow the Navy, and I wanted to join the Navy at 16, but my father told the papers up, he wouldn't let me go. He said, no, you need it here to look after your mother. And therefore, I helped to relinquish that.
Now, what about the outbreak of war itself? Do you remember the day or the broadcast or anything?
Yes, I do remember the broadcast quite clearly. You know, on 3rd of September 1939, and I remember... Finland saying, and consequently we are at war with Germany. I said, hooray, and my father slapped me down. He said, you'll regret that. And I many times thought, I'll regret that. When I tossed him down by the dumbest. I thought that's what he meant, you know. But
I also
wanted to join the Navy. I was good.
Now, what about when the war was declared, how did that affect your work at Berkeley?
The effect is very much because I that's why I joined the Navy. I thought I was put out by the women all taking over the armaments works, you know, and we were being squeezed out. You see, I was a young lad, you know, and I thought young lads should be away fighting. They shouldn't be here. I was 19 then, you see, and I thought I should be away for the forces. I shouldn't be here.
So one thing that happened was that women workers came in.
Yes, that's right. And they were very nice, women workers. They were very nice, but I was very unsettled. I was very unsettled. I thought I shouldn't be there, you know. And
were you in a restricted occupation? I mean, were you allowed to join up?
Yes, I was in a restricted occupation there, being in an armaments works. Yes, of course I was. And I went and volunteered for the Navy three times, I think it was. And I was... sent back each time, and my boss said, he said the third time, he said, right, go and get shot. He said, that's it. that was his remark. Go and get shot. He said, you damn fool, go and get shot. So that was it. But I was determined to go, and that was it, you know. And the Navy was the only place for me at that time. And when I went to Durham to join the Navy,
Now this is in August 1941.
That's right.
So nothing else much had happened in the first 2 years of the war. Just the women coming in. No other effects.
That's right. Well, I was in the church choir. I was always in the church mind. I was good attender of church. You know, then, and my brother being a clergyman, of course, a clergyman then. But you know, my mother was very religious. My mother was a good church choir. That's me. And therefore, we were brought up in the tradition of the church, you know, Church of England, of course. And I was in the church choir all the time until I was 20, and until I went into the Navy.
I think you may have misheard me. I was asking about any other effects of the war before you joined up in the first 2 years?
Well, the war didn't affect us much up here, except that the train, there was bombers on the train, you know, and then Sunderland as well, you know, they were bombed. But we got our bombs. We got one at Chelsea Street, didn't we? Yes, we did. One main landmine dropped at Chelsea Street. We slept through it.
Was there any Home Guard or LA Local Defence Volunteers? Were you in them? Or?
No. I didn't join any of them.
Well, tell me about going to enlist then. This was in August 1941. So your boss had... how had you lost your reserved occupation? Did the boss just agreed or what?
Well, yes. The boss said to me, you know, that's it. You know, go on and get shot. That's it, sort of thing. But he released me eventually, you know, and that was it, you see. So I went up in the Navy, and of course everything went through then. The Navy.
Well, where did you go to join up?
Durham.
Whereabouts?
There was the Durham recruiting officer at that time, of course. Everybody was going there, young lads for the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army, of course.
Do you remember what happened? How they sort of examined you and took you in?
Well, there's one thing he asked me. He said, "Can you swim, son?" And I couldn't, of course, then. I couldn't swim at all then. And I said, "No, I can't." I better be truthful here. I said, "No, I can't." He said, "Well, you know, if you swim the Atlantic." That's it. See, so that was it. And I thought, that would have bad me, you see. No. I said, no, your son learned. He said, "Yeah." And by God, I did learn as well.
Was there any sort of intelligence test? Because they put most people into the army at that stage.
Yes, there was an intelligence test. Well, not much, mine, not much. But it was a preliminary test. And most were going to the army. And the elites were supposedly going to the Air Force, and others were going to the Navy. I think my enthusiasm for joining the Navy took me in good stead, you know. A lot of people said, "How did you get in there, Navy?" You know, lads who had been in the army said, "How did you do that?" I said, "I don't know." But I said, I said a preference for the Navy, you know. And I've always been interested. I've got books like you have on Captain Vassar's stories. I've got books on the Navy all over the place, you know.
Now, what happened when you joined up? Did they take you straight away? Or
yes, they did. And they sent me my papers, my enlistment papers, yes. And it told me to report to Plymouth, to HMS Raleigh, Torpoint. HMS Raleigh, Torpoint.
HMS Raleigh?
Raleigh, yes. R-A-L-E-E-R-G-H, Raleigh.
And was that a shore station?
Yes, it was. At Torpoint in Cornwall, just across the way from Plymouth.
And what happened, do you remember the journey down there?
Yes, vividly, yes. I set off from Chester Street here, and I caught the train to Durham, and then caught the main line. No, I didn't go on the train to Durham. I went to Durham, and then got on the train to Durham. With my mother and my sister and so forth, and my brother. To see me off, you see. Took me 18 hours to get the first. 18 hours, call about the same nowadays.
Were there any others in there? Was there a draft of you, or was it just...
Yes, there were two lads from Sackerson as well. There was one, I don't remember, let me think. Stan Selway was one, and Bobby Keyes was the other one. And Bobby Keyes went into Asics as I did, about to come to that later.
Now, what happened when you got to Torpoint?
Well, we did our basic training, which was...
What was your reception like when you actually got there? How did you arrived as a civilian almost, and then how did they take you in?
Well, you know, you've left your mother now, lads, you know, but this lad's your mother, you know, a chief petty officer, who knew it all, you know, an old chief petty officer. What was his name?
Doesn't matter.
Yes, he was like your mother too, as it was. Dear me, what was his name? It might come back.
What about kitting out?
Kitting out.
What did you get? Do you remember what uniform and kit?
Well, kitting out was peculiar, I thought, because you've got uniforms for every occasion. You know, for tropics and for the Arctic and all over the place, you know. Actually, I didn't go to the Arctic. I went on my man's convoys on the dump. It's in that book, it's listed there.
So, can you tell us more about the kit you got?
Yes, yes. We kit for everything. You've got your shoe polish boots, your shoe polish gear, and your vests and your pants and everything else, you know. You were kitted up. And you've got number ones and number threes. Now, number ones had gold badges, you know, when you got badges later. And your number threes were working gear, you know. You had to wear a uniform, but to work in.
So number one was your best uniform?
Number one was your best one. You went to divisions and services and things like that with your best one on. Number threes were your ordinary kit that you were muck up. And you got a pair of overalls as well. You always covered them in paint, you know, when you were painting ship. And you paint with a brush, you know. You didn't have the spray like they do now.
And what about your accommodation? What were you living? Were you in barracks?
Miss Nuts, you know, those times, yes. Miss Nuts.
What were they like, the huts with the sail, you know?
They were quite reasonable, I thought. Looking at them, I think they were quite reasonable. There were about 30 of you in a Miss Nut like that, you know. And you were in divisions as well. I was in four top divisions, I remember.
What about the hut? What sort of bed and storage and the rest of it did you have?
Well, you all had your own bed, you know, and you were in lines like that, one each side. You see, the gangway down the middle, and you were lined up like that, you know. And when you got up in the morning, you got most of the wash basin, wash your ablutions, you know, and off you went.
And what about storage? What did you have?
Storage was a locker. Beneath your bed, a locker with a lid on, you know, and you could get everything in there, everything. And that was almost throughout my never career. It was a locker, you know, with all the gear in, you know.
And were the huts heated or were they?
Yes, they were heated. Yes, they were. And they had a huge parade ground, and on the edge of the parade ground was the water. Quite deep it was. And there was a mast at the side of the parade ground, and halyards and all the rest of it. And you did your knots and places on there, you know.
I'll come to that. So
during the course, you did your knots and places and all the rest, and you're going to be training and all the rest of it.
Well, let's look at a typical day's training. We'll pick up all these things. How would your day start then?
Well, your day started when you arose, you know, in the early morning. I can't remember how far early it was. 6 o'clock or something like that, and you were lined up, you know, and you did your drills, you know, and you could know your own petty officer, chief petty officer, shouting his voice. He could just stand right here and there with the parade ground. You could pick his voice out, and all the rest of the squad were busy as well.
So you had a long drill session.
Oh yeah.
What did you think of foot drill?
Oh well, I thought it was disciplinary training. Well, the essence of it was you did what you were told, strictly what you were told, to the letter. And I could see the point in that when I got to see later, because doing what you were told was more important, most important.
Did you find drill boring, or did you sort of realise quite early on why they were doing it?
I think we all found it boring because you did what you were told, you did nothing for yourself. Now, I used to like to think for myself, and I found that very... ostentatious, we'll say. But I struck it, and I thought, well, you know, it will find me some good said later, and it did.
So that's drill. That the drill session, what about the food? We haven't looked at that. So
The food was very ordinary, you know, very ordinary, but very wholesome.
What sort of things would you get, or do you not remember these days?
Oh, I don't know.
Not important to you.
I can't remember the usual things that we had in those days from our mining days, you know, from now and back. Fair, just sparse fare, you know, but it was adequate. And so it was very sustaining as well, you know, the sustenance was good.
And you got enough of it?
Oh, yes, yes. The Navy were always well fed. In fact, I'm a lad later, if I nearly go on a bit, I'm a lad who took passage on Navy ships, always said, by God, you're well looked after. And we were. I mean, we got fried eggs and things like this when the civilians didn't get it, you know. And we were well looked after in the Navy itself.
What about other training sessions you might know? You've got drill.
Gunnery training.
Tell me about gunnery training.
Well, again, everything was regimented in the Navy. You know, you were a gun layer, or you were a gun something else. You were number one, number two, number three, number four, up to eight, you know, and you did what that number did. You know, in the planning of firing a gun, you have to do what you're told.
Which gun were you trained on?
4-inch usually, 4-inch and 6-inch guns, but they are big guns for 6-inch, but 4-inch guns mainly. And then you were given small arms training, like, you know, you had to fire a light rifle, you know, and that sort of thing. And the funny thing was, I always remembered you fired a rifle at the butts on shore, but you did it from a pontoon. You were going down like this, you know. I missed the first 7, I think it was, or the first 3. And I said to the petty officer, I said, "How the devil did you fire this thing?" He said, "Come here." And he lay down next to me. He said, "You sighted this way, you know." And I hit the next 3. But that probably saved my bacon then, you know. But he was very good, was the old chief petty officer. Sorry, I forgot his name.
What did you think of him? What made him so good? We'll talk about him.
I thought he was a fair man, you know. He was a very fair man. His justice was absolutely spot on, you know. That if he thought he'd got to doing something wrong, he punished you. And he did something good, he congratulated you. He had his fire with him. And given him my teaching after that, I did the same thing.
Did he know his stuff?
Well, he knew. He was an old seaman, and he knew it inside out. And if you want to know anything, you went back to him. He would tell you and he would explain it to you. He would explain. And I think that was the essence of Navy life, you know. That I always enjoyed people who were in authority. For instance, if you were told to do something by an officer, went later on.
I'll come back to that because I do see where were all the petty officers and leading seamen at the training camp, were they all as good or? Or did you just really see this one?
We didn't have leading seamen in the training camp very much. We had chief petty officers, old chief petty officers, and they knew their stuff. He was a Cornwallian, this old man, and he knew his stuff.
And they were all much of them. They were all as good as each other.
They were all chief petty officers.
And they're all good as each other.
They were. They competed with each other for to be best. You know, they were good. They were absolutely marvellous. In fact, they were gods. You know. And all of us were about the same age, except we had one man who was in his 30s then, in the training establishment. And he was like us, he'd just been taken in, you know, at that age, 36. And he had to survive with us.
How did you get on amongst yourselves, the recruits?
We got on very well, actually. I was in a section that got on very well. You know, we didn't have any rebels, really, that I remember. I don't remember any rebels or people of the trace. Oh, there's one man I remember. You know, when they march, you know, you march like this. He marched with the foot out at the same time as the next time I saw him, he was leading Seaman. but in the training establishment, they called him Stevenson, and he was from Cumbria. And he was always...
Was it from all over the country and different backgrounds? Or?
We're a lot from the northeast. My batch was from the northeast as well, you know. And those two lads, Selway and Keir, I stayed with all the time in my training. You know,
there was no bullying then, from the sound of it. No trouble.
I think we were far too busy. He kept us so busy, this old petty officer. He kept us so busy that he didn't have time to get into trouble.